accession number 4666, Rule 2.
Lord Gridley, Rule 2. Tell me a bit more about exactly how you did organise the rice dumps.
The first project that we had to do was to find areas where it was possible to store these huge quantities of rice fairly near a port, and therefore find warehouses of which it was not difficult to find, and dock it and keep a record of everything that had come in. Carry out the general scheme, which was to supply, you have sufficient rice for 6 months to 8 months. This was the general idea, as I say, of a siege or an attack on the country, and keep a record of the areas over which a particular dump was earmarked for the supplies of rice to reach various districts. Basically, that's what it was all about. I think difficult to elaborate very much more.
It was done pretty straightforwardly.
It was done very, very straightforwardly.
No problem.
There was a question of transport. One wished to keep it fairly near rail transport. We had a rail line which ran from north to south of Malaya and right down into Singapore. And therefore, obviously, if one was wanting to move rice in any great quantity, one would hope that it would be possible to use the rail service for that operation. Eventually, if I may just rush ahead on and say what did happen, of course, during the attack, was we were attacked and overrun so quickly that basically what I did was, that before we were evacuated from any area, was to inform the local population where the rice was and give them access to take sufficient stores, advise them to do so to keep themselves alive. This is a very rough and ready method of doing things, but as I say, the most important point that one had to take decisions on one's own, and my feeling of the matter was that it was better to get the rice distributed to the people in the country, tell them where it was, let them go and help themselves, for heaven's sake, because that the object was to keep them alive, at least to look after them, to eat, at least to demonstrate to them that at least we'd done something for them at that particular time.
Am I right in the impression that I'm getting that there was a measure of concealment involved in the storage of the rice initially?
Yes, I think that is absolutely true. We didn't obviously wish it to be known or possibly get out to anybody who might attack us where the rice was. It was done on a secret basis. Although, in a country like that, when you're shifting large quantities of bags of rice, it's exceedingly difficult to conceal what you're doing.
Yes.
But you don't shout it at them. You don't go and shout it about the plane.
Before the outbreak of war, were there any other preparations in the part of Malaya you were working in taken by the European community?
I'm afraid not.
No.
No, there wasn't anything. I don't think we really knew what was going to happen to us.
Was there not any real sense of alarm?
There was no sense of alarm, and in some degree there was too much complacency, I feel. That may be a personal opinion, that may be unfair.
What sort of things gave you that impression?
I think it was the climate. I think that people were used to not worrying too much in Malaya. There was a feeling that if an attack came, it would come by sea and the Japanese wouldn't be able to get through the jungle on land, and that Singapore would never fall. We got this naval base and so on. There was
a sense of security?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think there was a lot of sense of anxiety, but very difficult. When you're overseas like that, It's not as if you're in your own country. You're living amongst a population who are different to you, a different nationality, and it's exceedingly difficult. Looking back now to sort of visualise exactly what the situation was.
What about the local community? Were you aware of any reactions amongst the Malays and the Chinese to the threat of invasion by the Japanese?
I don't think, looking back, I don't think they reacted over much. I think they probably thought this was a quarrel between the British and the Japanese, and which they were not involved. And if I may just elaborate slightly on that, it hurt me when I saw how stupid some of them were under attack. They would go out into the street and look up in the sky when the Japanese bombers were over, and be blown to smithereens. They wouldn't go for, in the first days of war, they wouldn't go for cover. These people had never seen a war. They had never visualised what a war could be. They thought it was a magnificent sight to see Japanese bombers overhead and with their red circles of rising sun on their wings and that kind of thing. And they, in Penang, they suffered terrible casualties on a beautiful, beautiful sunny morning, the sort of morning you get in the Far East out there, the beautiful blue sea underneath you, Penang Island standing as it did, as I saw it that morning, from what I was over on the other side of the water. Japanese bombers came over, 27 of them, I think, and loosed their bombs on Georgetown. And the casualties were terrible. People went out in the streets to look at them.
I take it there were no air raid precautions?
No. There were not, no. It was only latterly after the first attack in Malaya, which was on Penang, Penang Island. After that, there were frantic efforts to... after that episode, people blown to smithereens and...
Closing the door after the horses bolted.
That's right, that's right. Well, during the Japanese attack, I was living right in the north of Malaya, and where the attack came. The campaign lasted something like 5 weeks. And during the whole of that 5 weeks, I was on retreat all the way down to Singapore. The circumstances were these. As I say, I was living in the north. My duties more or less finished I made arrangements for the evacuation of Penang took place after the bombing when I was up there. I was on the other side of the water. Penang was evacuated. I was over on the mainland directly opposite Penang. The person in charge of communications was the district officer at Butterworth. He was in direct touch with the military authorities. I don't quite know where. But my job was to liaise with him, and after the Japanese took Penang Island and came across from Kedah into Kedah, which was north of where I was, we were eventually permanently cut off. Now, my duties then were to see that my staff knew that I had been instructed to withdraw to a new line further south, to impress upon them that so far as we were concerned, the war was not over, and it was essential for us to withdraw to a better area where we could deal with the Japanese. The whole of that time, the whole of that 3 to 4 weeks, the Japanese were continually coming down by sea from Penang Island, landing behind our front line, cutting us off, coming in behind us, behind our military forces, cutting us off, and at the same time they were sending their fighting forces on bicycles, of all things, down the main roads of Malaya and attacking what forces we had there. The situation was this, that I maintained contact with our front line. I was continually in use with officers of our army in interpreting Malay, the Malay language to them, because quite obviously as they retired, they kept in contact with the local population. They were always asking questions about certain incidents which they might have noticed or they might be suspicious about, which the Malays might well know, and whether there were people coming into their villages or kampongs, whether the Japanese were coming in. The other instance in which I was used was the fact that a Malay and a Japanese looked very much the same in colouring, and it was exceedingly difficult on occasions to pick out which were Japanese and which were Malays to fire at, and I always did my best to stop, to be very careful that they were not picking off any Malays. When I got to Kuala Lumpur, which was about the end of the first fortnight, and which was the capital of Malaya, I was used again. I went to the police station one night, and a curfew was on. British people, the British commander had put a curfew on. That meant to say that no Chinese should be out or nobody should be on the streets. And while I was sitting in the police station, a British military policeman brought in a young Chinese off the streets and asked me to interpret. I sat down at a table. I took down this Chinese boy's statement to the questions of the British military policeman, who was behind my back with a Tommy gun. And while this was going on, our troops were withdrawing on the road outside, guns going through, military withdrawing, and it was only a few hours before that place fell. There was one question. I suppose I've been questioning this chap for about 10 or 15 minutes. He looked to me completely innocent. He gave one answer. The British military policeman picked up his Tommy gun and shot him dead right over my shoulder, just like that. I reported that incident after the war, but I don't wish to make any excuses for it. I can only say that as an illustration of the awful jitters that some of our people were in during that long retreat down the country. This British military policeman was convinced that this Chinese had been out and was only picking up the numbers of convoys and guns and the military who were retreating, as I say, outside the police station down that road, and he thought the best thing to do was to put him out of his misery and kill him. But this made me feel quite sick. Made me feel quite sick. That was one incident. The next incident was that I went down to Gemas, where I told you in an earlier an account of what happened, and I went down to Gemas, and there the Australians had decided that they would take on the Japanese tanks as they came. They were using tanks then, down the war. They were small tanks, very small tanks by today's standards. And they put an ambush up for these tanks, and I was on the southern side of that, on the southern side near the Singapore side. They held the Japanese there for a considerable time. They knocked out about five Japanese tanks, and it looked as if we might hold a line through Gemas and therefore be able to carry out a long siege when we finally withdrew into Singapore. That people who fought exceedingly well there were the Australians, under General Gordon. The General Commander. I reserve that because I'm not quite sure whether that's his correct name. Gordon Bennett, that's right. It was General Gordon Bennett who held this line. Unfortunately, Japanese infiltrated once more further by sea behind the Gemas line. And finally, it was decided that the only thing that could be done was to withdraw into our fortress of Singapore, blow up the causeway. I went across the causeway. As soon as I got across the causeway, which links Singapore Island and Johor, this was blown up. And we'd settled down in our island fortress of Singapore.
For you as a refugee, What were the, personally, the main problems or difficulties of that long retreat down through Milan?
A long retreat, I was always in touch with the military. I was always able to get food somewhere or other. I was very, very tired, very, very exhausted by all this experience when I got to Singapore, and I must say I slept there for about 48 hours. What other points? One made it, it was of great importance never to lose contact with what was happening. It's difficult now to recall the organizations that existed which ensured that we were in contact with vital news. There was always somebody deputed for a withdrawal to see that message got through to you to get back before you might have been, before there was danger of you being so badly cut off that you couldn't get back. I mean, in certain cases in that retreat, known to me now, many of our forces were cut off.
Did that ever happen to you?
Well, it happened to me once.
What happened?
I managed to... Well, we were cut off, and I happened to go through rubber estates and across river with a patrol of people and managed to get back on the right side of the line, you know. This was constantly happening. Mm. You've got to understand that Malaya is a country with a very thick rubber plantations and thick jungle. And it's possible to use all kinds of routes to get out. And, I mean, the country, the terrain helped us to do this. But we were never quite sure that passing through Malay villages or Chinese villages, which occurred quite frequently, that these people might not give us away to Japanese. I mean, there was a question of...
Mixed loyalties?
Mixed loyalties in some cases. Mixed loyalties through fear. Seeing that the British were being defeated, the people who would never have been defeated in normal circumstances, the myth had grown up, we were invincible. Mm. And these people had to look to their future, and they're very shrewd.
How did that affect the way you treated these villages during the retreat and the way you went through them?
We treated them generally in a friendly way. One would open a conversation with them, and one could more or less judge from their bearing and their attitude, whether they would be fairly straight and not give us away. Some of them helped us boats, gave us their boats to get across a particular stream to safety. Some of them would tell us that the Japanese were only perhaps a mile or half a mile away. They'd seen somebody up a creek in the morning. They would give us this information. Generally, they were helpful. But, of course, you cannot... These are the risks which you had to face. You had to use your own judgment. And in a war like that, these people generally were terrified towards the end. They'd never seen a war on this scale. They'd never seen the might of war arms and so on.
Can you remember any specific occasion when they were not helpful?
There were occasions.
Describe them.
There was one occasion when we were given a boat, which was obviously a boat which was going to sink, and they damn well knew it, and we couldn't get across. Was there any other occasion? It's very difficult.
What was the period in Singapore like for you personally before the Japs actually occupied the island?
Personally for me, it was a period of rest. I suppose I arrived in Singapore about 10 days to 12 days before its final capitulation. I was very tired. In the Organization for the Defense of Singapore, that had been taken by other people. I was allowed to go to the customs house near the front there, where we were all situated at that particular time, with our beds, our bedding. We'd taken them to the offices in Singapore. We had a canteen there, and it was easy to feed. And it was there where I was when the actual surrender, when Percival actually surrendered.
Mm-hmm. At that time, while you were waiting in the customs centre, mm-hmm. what was the general expectation that Singapore would fall or that it wouldn't fall?
I think before the attack on Singapore took place, the general expectation in Singapore was that we were capable of keeping the Japanese, prevent the Japanese from coming across the Straits of Johor and landing on Singapore Island. We had 20 or 30,000 troops available. It was felt that we could pick them off in the Straits of Johor and they wouldn't land. That was the feeling in Singapore. It was soon dissipated after about the first 2-3 days when the Japanese did land quite easily and advanced on Singapore. I don't know.
For you personally, and I stress personally, well, do you remember what your reaction was when all those expectations proved to have been?
I think my reaction was very much what the other people in my position's reaction was. First of all, we didn't know whether we'd be shot because we were not in uniform, and the Japanese had a. This is no exaggeration to say they had a penchant for everybody being a spy. Anybody who was not in uniform was not of this earth. The lowest of the low. I don't think any of us really knew what was going to happen.
I think I was really wondering whether there was a sort of profound shock that the island had fallen so quickly, given your expectations before the attack.
I think the profound shock we had was the shock of incessant bombardment, incessant shelling. It was more a feeling of helplessness and hopelessness than actual shock. We'd been more or less conditioned to what war was like. Mm-hmm. It was more nearly despair that this could have happened, this should have happened to us. I think that would be the general feeling which everybody felt at that particular time.
The myth of invulnerability.
That's right. That's right. I mean, in the first few days of the war, Japanese demonstrated to us only too clearly that they were a force to be reckoned with. They were ferocious. They made wherever they went, they attacked very ferociously. They didn't mind deaths. They didn't mind, they didn't mind people dying or being killed. And their glory was to fight for the emperor, and they fought like madmen.
At what stage were you transferred to Changi? How did that come about?
That came about the first 2 or 3 days. Negotiate.
What happened to you personally?
A Japanese came into the building one morning and informed all of us that we were to be moved to Changi Jail, and we were to get all our equipment or what we wanted to take there ready, and we were not to have transport. We should have to walk the 7 or 8 miles through Singapore barefooted or whatever it was and march to Changi Jail and that's where we would be. That would be our home. That's just what happened, and we went out the following morning.
What possessions were you able to take with you?
We were able to take what we had. I had a pair of shorts which lasted for 5 years and which stank. I mean, that's all I had, and was sewn up with gunny sacks, so bits of sacking. We took a few medicines. One didn't want to be laden down with too much weight. It's possible, of course, in a hot country to have very few clothes. You only want light clothes, and clothes which will keep you warm at night and so on. Mattresses we took because we light mattress we had. We took what we could, mosquito nets, our clothes, and that was it.
Did you have any idea at that stage what was going to happen to you?
No, absolutely none. We were soon to know.
If you had been able to see the future, how would that have influenced, do you think, the things that you might have taken?
I think the most important things to have taken, seeing the future, if one could have seen the future at that time, But certainly the basic stocks of medicines, which are very essential. More clothes than we certainly were allowed to take. Basically, we couldn't have taken food. I mean, our main necessity was food, in the end, to keep us alive. So, and we couldn't take that. So, I think I've said more or less what we should take for this.
Did the Japanese themselves place any limitations upon what you could take with you?
Yes, I mean, they told us you take the basic things, like if you've got a mattress, you can take it. You take clothes. That's all you're allowed to take, kind of business. You're going to Changi, and, you know, you'll be subject to Japanese discipline, and there'll be a Japanese commander there, and you can get organized when you get in there. Take what you have now, and that's it. I mean, they didn't give us any instructions. The Japanese people, I don't think they worked out the organization necessary. They would get us there and then see how it turned out when we were there. That was the position, as far as they were concerned.
Well, that would be your first experience of treatment at Japanese hands, that walk to that 8-mile hike to Changi. What was their general treatment, if you like, on that occasion?
Pretty terrible. Of course, they
explain.
I'll explain. It was a brutal thing to make Europeans walk 8 miles in a tropical sun. Some of them very unfit, some of them tired, walking to jail. That was a brutal thing to do. And we had some women. I don't know whether I told you this before, but we had some nursing sisters with us. And as we walked up that hill into Changi Jail, at the top of their voices, they sang a very popular song at that time, and "They'll Always Be in England." That was the spirit of which, at the end of that long march. Now, the object of that long march was to attract the local population, to see how the white man had been degraded. And there were thousands of them out in the streets as we marched through Singapore, watching us carrying and being marched by these Japanese guards to jail. That was, of course, Japanese intended that.
What were your first impressions of Changi? Could you give me as detailed a description of it as you can manage, of what the place looked like and what its layout was?
Yeah. Well, when I arrived at Changi, there's a usual reception, which we have at any jails. It's a modern jail. I was quite impressed with it. It seemed airy. It seemed clean. Its cells were spacious for one prisoner. It had all the modern appurtenances necessary to run a big jail. It had a very first-class kitchen. It had a hospital. It had an administrative wing. It had plenty of running water, although it wasn't turned on when we arrived, and we were 48 hours before we got it, but it had that. So my first impressions were, I was relieved to be alive, if you really want to know. I thought, well, it's not too bad. I'll try and put up with this. I mean, that was my attitude.
Could be worse.
Could be worse, yes. That was my impressions where it could have been much worse. And there's a feeling, after all, we're all together. We've come through this. We're alive. Thank God for that. And we've made the best of what we're going to face now. That was the attitude.
When you arrived at the camp, was there any form of reception processing?
We were all examined. I had some binoculars, which I'm ashamed to say that in the bombing of Singapore, everything was scattered all over the place. I picked up some very good pair of Zeiss binoculars. They'd been scattered through the street when some place had been bombed. I thought, listen, I might as well help myself. A Japanese got hold of those, and he gave me hell and slapped my face and said I was a spy and I took this off me and all the rest of it. And you say, what happened when we went in? We were all treated to that sort of treatment. Searched, sent into the jail, not told where to go. All this had to be negotiated later on when we appointed our own people and so on. Mm-hmm.
There was no documentation?
No, not then. Mm. Not then.
Any issues of any kind?
Nothing. No issues, nothing. Just go to your place.
How did you know where your place was?
Well, the position was this, that we were told to sit down for a long hours, and then when the Japanese commander came in, people were summoned to him, and we were told in various, there was a certain number of cells in various blocks, and people were allocated a cell, three to a cell, because of our numbers. Changi would hold 600. We were something like 1,800 people in being interned there at that particular time. The first few days, I would say that the relationship between the Japanese and ourselves is reasonably good. There's quite a good deal of communication and cooperation between those of us who were there and the Japanese who were responsible for us. Therefore, it was possible to get organized and settle down in the running of what you might call the internment camp.
Yes. In that very early period, was any information available to you about, you know, your rights as internees and also about your obligations as to your Japanese captors?
Yeah. Basically, I could say that in about three words. And they said to us, if you want to live, you're going to have to grow your own vegetables. We have no right to feed you, so far as you're concerned. I mean, this is basically what they've said.